Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your patience. We're a little bit over time, but I think we have plenty of time to catch up. We ought to close the door if we could. Good morning to everybody. This is a topic that's long overdue, I think, to be addressed in Washington. In fact, we've been trying to get it done, Joel and I, for several months, this issue of humanitarian assistance in Burma. It extended from several conversations that I had with folks who were doing work in Burma, including talking to Soros Foundation people who were thinking about it and trying to navigate the shoals of the Burma issue. And then we had an event here at CSIS where there was a bit of a discussion, a back and forth, where some of the facts were uncertain about this topic. And as we mark the very sad one-year anniversary of the events of last September, October in Burma, it does, I think, behoove us to look freshly at the issue and look at this issue particularly of humanitarian assistance, because anything regarding Burma, as I think you all know, gets a bit controversial. Even something like humanitarian assistance, which seems very straightforward. We want to help the people of Burma. Let's go in and work directly with them to give them whatever assistance we can, given that the government is not. But it is rather tricky because of the politics of humanitarian assistance in Burma, about how you operate in Burma, and how, in my dealings with Aung San Suu Kyi, she saw the issue. And maybe Peter can discuss that. If not, then I can go into my own personal experience with the issue just 10 years ago. I haven't been back since, unfortunately. But clearly, what's happening on the political side is not working, and people are suffering. So I think it behooves us to have a discussion, a debate, to talk about this issue, to find something, maybe a line there, where the people of Burma could get some aid, even if we are not aiding the government. And we have three folks who have worked directly in Burma or on the Burma issue very deeply, both here in Washington and out in Asia. And what we're going to do is go from your right on over. First, we have Ted Nguyen, who is the founder of an organization called the U.S. Collection Humanitarian Corps that works directly in Burma and providing humanitarian assistance. He is of Burmese descent. He and his wife, who also is Burmese, who came out a few years ago, have gone back and worked on the ground. And his experience, I think, is instructive. He has sort of a video and a PowerPoint presentation to provide you all. You have a little snippet there. The surprise is somehow slightly ruined. But I think you'll still enjoy what he has to say from his personal recent experience. And then Joel Charney, the Vice President for Policy at Refugees International, formerly of the United Nations, and at Oxfam America, someone who is passionate on the subject generally of humanitarian assistance and refugee aid around the world, and I think on this particular issue of Burma has a very strong opinions. And Peter Yeo from the House Foreign Affairs Committee can provide the Hill perspective. Those of you who know the Burma issue know that Capitol Hill plays a very direct and sometimes determinant role in our policy towards Burma. So I thought it was very useful to get the perspective of Capitol Hill legislation that constricts our humanitarian assistance, the standards by which we do humanitarian assistance in Burma. I wanted to get that perspective as well. I also know there are folks here in the audience. It's a relatively small group, and I know folks here also have their experiences. I hope this to be a discussion that more perspectives are provided from you all, both on the ground and here in Washington, about the issue. So after their presentations, I would want to open it up. It doesn't have to be Q&A. Usually folks say, you must have a question. You don't have to have a question. If you have a statement, if you have a comment, we want to hear that. And usually those things are like questions. It will get a back and forth. It can get a little emotional on the Burma issue. I hope it doesn't get too emotional. I hope it's not more heat than light. I would like to be very serious on this because it's a serious issue that should not be politicized but be looked at because I think everybody in the room has the same bottom line, which is how do we help the people of Burma during their time of need? I think everybody here has that same goal, and I hope people think of it in that context. So let me turn first to Ted Nguyen. I'd provide his presentation. We'll move along accordingly.
Thank you, Derek. Good morning, everyone. I'm here today on behalf of U.S. Collection. Before I start the presentation, just a few words about U.S. Collection. One morning, I heard a voice, and that voice said, "You must help the people of Myanmar. You must save the people." And that voice was my wife. waking me up in the morning. And there's an old Burmese proverb that says, listen to your wife, keep your teeth for life. So she says it also applies to the mother-in-law. So that's how, as an immigrant family, you know, there's always traditions that we give back to our family and neighbors back in the old country. So I've always had that tradition in my family. And in 2005, my friends and family, we decided to incorporate U.S. Collection and make it an official organization. So before going on this mission in August, I called all my friends, family, asked for as many donations as possible. And I even called up Hollywood. I know some people are interested, some celebs. I've seen them on YouTube. So, all righty then. Why couldn't we get Richard Gere, right? This is just for your reference. Rangoon is here, and Bogalay and Labuda is around here. Here's Rangoon, Yangon, I think. So it's about 150, 200 miles in this area. This is where the cyclone hit the hardest. But it's terribly difficult to get down there. It's almost like a one-way trip. Once you get down there, you're going to be down there for a while. The cyclone just destroyed all the roads. I didn't even make it all the way down into Bogalay City, just the outskirts. But it's the natural disaster is quite horrible. There's a strange smell in the air, and it's just an eerie feeling, like you're in a graveyard. Derek told me to keep it at 10, 15 minutes. I've got 100 slides here, but I can't do them all. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. And just make comments on things that I think it's important. And if you'd like to ask a question about a slide you saw and I didn't make a comment, please tell me. So when you think of Myanmar, I don't think you think of hip-hop. But this is in Yangon. This is June 6th, 1 month after the cyclone. It's a fundraising event put together by various artists in the musical community. And there was about 50 artists that came together. And I just want to show you this because you don't see this kind of thing when we're talking about Burma. And Yangon is, although the whole city is falling apart, the culture is alive. It's a center for business, politics, culture, and people are trying to survive. And, you know, people are trying to be happy. There are terrible things going on there, but people are trying their best. This is my friend Sai Sai. He's the Justin Timberlake of Myanmar. I've known him since he was a youngster, and I've been supporting him as a fan and a friend for a long time. And he's really been supportive of U.S. Collection. U.S. Collection is not known as U.S. Collection in Myanmar, but I can get to that later. This is our first stop. This is in Hlaing Thaya. This is on the outskirts of Yangon. There were about 70 families here. So it's just the family. So probably maybe around, I estimate, 120 people in this small strip of a village. Originally, this Hlaing Thaya community, this little village, didn't exist. Originally, there was it's an industrial zone, so there are many textile factories here. And people had moved to this area because there were jobs. And then by about 1994, I think, all the factories had shut down. So these people were left here. They had come from the countryside mostly. Now they're usually farmers or day laborers or servants. You can see how poor the people are. They don't even have a bucket or a plastic bag. We gave them these little bowls. This bowl here is 8 cups of rice, and we gave 24 cups to this village, each person, so 3 bowls. That'll last maybe about 3 weeks. I think this picture says it all right here, this little child. This rice is not the premium kind of rice or the best rice you can buy on the market. It's not the worst one either. It's below average. These people, I don't want to call them, these poor people, they prefer this kind of rice because it doesn't digest immediately. It sticks in their stomach. It's probably not good for them, but U.S. Collection is just about giving back, just making a difference. I've gone back to Myanmar since 1990, almost every year, every other year. Sorry. These pictures. This is Shui Bida. This is another small village on the outskirts of Yangon. This is Shui Bida means a little golden land. The land is not golden, but I think the people are beautiful. This is Matha and her son. She has two other children. And they're pretty upset because their house here, the roof was torn off during the cyclone. And we decided to fix her roof. So you go to the Home Depot, get your 2x4s of bamboo. And this is Go Thang, her husband. Go and Ma are honorifics in Burmese language, like a Mr. or Miss. But there's a higher form also, Da and U. So this is the next day. We got some engineers from the village, and they came to fix the roof. This is a temporary roof. There's just a few slats of reeds and bamboo. They need a real one. This material, I don't know the name of the material in English, but this material is some sort of sea reed, and it comes from Bogale. So there's another edition of Myanmar Extreme Makeover. Hopefully, Gotan has a job. He works in a coffee factory. Matan sells vegetables. And they own this land, and they own this house. So hopefully in the future, U.S. Collection can help them make a wooden house. U.S. Collection assisted in rebuilding the roofs of 6 more huts in this village. When you see tarp like this, blue tarp, this is usually provided by the Myanmar government. Myanmar, I don't mean to start controversy, Derek. Usually the tarp is dropped off at the airport and some of it is redistributed. I wanted to show you these sandbags in the village. They were donated by the local monk. So here I am. I have to go and pay respect to the local monk to thank him. People turn to the monks for help, and the monks guide the people and always help the people. These little novices here, people are so poor that they want their children, or they give their children up to the monastery, because at the monastery they can get food and they get education. So it's very similar to the madrasas, where people go there because there's education there, there's food there. And I think we learned a lot from last year with the Saffron Revolution about Myanmar society, Burmese society, and My wife, she's not old enough to remember. When she saw all this, she was like, oh, wow, we're going to get democracy now. This is it. And I was like, you know, you don't know about 888. After this protest, there's no cavalry coming. It's just going to be a beatdown. And it happened. I felt the same way back in 88 when I was a college student. And I was like, oh, Dad, it's going to be a change in Myanmar, in Burma. And my dad said, you don't know about 7762. It was much more violent then. There wasn't, nowadays, it's peaceful. I mean, a nonviolent protest. Back in my dad's day, it wasn't. This is Hlaing Thaya again, but this is closer to the industrial zone. This is actually a refugee camp. Many of the people came here from miles away because they lost their home. There must be millions of homeless people now. This was on our last day of giving out rice. We visited 6 villages, 6 sites. All these huts were provided by the Myanmar government. There's about 120 families here, and this was our last day, and we were a little overwhelmed with the number of people. And I'm like, honey, I need more rice. So here we could only give out 1 bowl. But the response from the people was really incredible. I mean, they were cheerful, and we came to listen to them. So they had all kinds of stories. about their hardship. And they just wanted to talk. And these people were, I mean, it was incredible how cheerful they were. And they just wanted to, they were happy to see us. They said World Vision had been down here one time since the storm. World Vision is probably the most active big NGO I've seen there. They've been there, I think, like over like 50 years. So they know how to work with the government. As for myself, I don't have to work with the government. This U.S. collection is, we'll have, you know, our neighbors, cells of people, cells of groups, and you can go out, you know what to do, and my job is just to organize them and find the people that need help. There's a sort of unspoken caste system in Burmese culture. So people usually don't donate to the most needy and vulnerable people. It's usually to the monks, because you want your good karma. So these people are quite helpless. They're usually farmers and day laborers, and they're just trying to make ends meet. And before you think Myanmar is all huts and mud, I just want Derek said. Derek was interested in this slide, I think. After 10 years, there are some buildings there now. Actually, I got my wedding ceremony was here, my wedding reception, Sedona Hotel. And when I saw General Tan Shui's daughter get married, she got married here too. For a moment, I felt guilty. But there's a one-year wait list here to have your wedding here, and it doesn't look any different from hers, except for the guest list. There is a growing middle class, but the class of poor people is also growing. It's a big problem. My cousins live here. They own a condo. This is kind of like the Ballston of Yangon. So this is about 8 years ago, they paid for a condo here, $60,000 equivalent, cash, all cash. That's how middle-class people pay for things. There's no credit. There's no bank. So they got to lay it out. I don't know how they do it. I don't know if it's real money. Could be from China. This is Ocean. This is the Walmart of Yangon. Just wanted to throw this in, give you an idea of what it looks like. But this is what most of the country looks like. This is Bogle. I didn't take this picture. This is on May 6th. See how everything is built close up to the shore, so it's not surprising how the storm surge had probably killed hundreds of thousands of people overnight. Some people say it was a 15-foot high surge. Some say it was 30. From what I saw, the water had come in maybe about 2-3 miles inland. The next few pictures are graphic. This sort of embankment was not here originally. This water is too high. I don't know how to describe the nature of it, but it had collapsed all the earth around it and just moved in and washed everything away. You can see here how everything is caked with mud. All this used to be underwater, and this is not supposed to be here. This is like a river now. That whole area is like peninsulas and very large rivers, so it's very hard to navigate. The next few pictures are also graphic and may make you even more emotional. Yeah, that's a real live general. Now you're going to say, oh, no wonder he could get his pictures because he's working with the government. Well, you know, I have uncles that are still active in the military. I have grand uncles who are retired from the military. And I have friends who are enlisted soldiers. And my wife's father, he's retired. And his father was in the military. And he had fought the British and the Japanese. And my wife's other grandfather was a personal assistant to General Aung San. And my wife's that grandfather, he died in prison for his political beliefs. So there are good soldiers in the army. There are decent men. And I think the U.S. should somehow find them. It doesn't help to demonize the whole military. I think it creates animosity. And pick one, you know, Saddam, Noriega, something. But to lump them all together, it doesn't help. You know, I've known General Teng Aung for many years, and I know he's a decent man, but you might see a pig with lipstick. This was on May 14th. This aid is from Thailand. Aid does get to the people. It takes a lot of work. This is from World Vision. And this water is from Japan. It does get through. Myanmar has relations with other countries. It doesn't have a good relation with us. So that's what we should develop. You can't just go in right away. I mean, we're first world people, so we understand what civilization is about. They don't understand. They're like 100 years behind. So we need to teach them. I believe there are people that are open to being taught. This is an interesting slide. If somebody wants to ask a question about it, you can. This is at the end of August, about August 30th, I think. The rebuilding had begun. This is my favorite three slides here. This is the warehouse. Means warehouse. Here this means Lebe, victims of the cyclone. I can't read the other one. But this is the warehouse. When the big NGOs bring all their supplies, USAID brings their supplies there, lands at the airport, and is taken by truck. And then once it gets here, 30% of it gets stolen. And somebody asked me who stole it. This is Naypyidaw. This is not my slide. This is from the internet. I want to show you that after all these years, the military is stronger. I mean, they built a whole brand new city. I was there. It's a huge city. It might be empty, but people are going to move there one day because Yangon, there's no electricity, no sanitation, and it's falling apart. So people are going to move there one day. Joe Tourist in Naypyidaw. It's free to enter. There's no problem taking pictures, anything. Nobody's there. This is the symbol of Naypyidaw, a lotus blossom. If somebody is interested to talk about astrology, feel free. It's a very important thing in Myanmar culture. You know, but people always say how the generals are so superstitious. Superstition didn't build these buildings. And astrology didn't build an aqueduct or supply free water or make all these hotels. It was, I mean, a real effort to put it all together and to plan it. And it shows that they can do it. There's about 30,000 units. And they're probably just as good as any public housing in Singapore. That's my wife, queen for a day. These cars are government vehicles. They're going to try to make all the government vehicles run on natural gas now. I think it's called compressed gas. I'm not sure. This is a 7-liter tank, and I think 1 liter you can get maybe about 20 miles on it. I'm not sure. I'd have to ask somebody again. These are pictures of teak trees. If somebody's interested in talking about timber, this is about how tourism helps local merchants. Foreign investment helps local businessmen. Doesn't go to the generals. This is about U.S. collection, just being a symbol and trying to help the people and make a small difference, just giving back. I mean, I grew up here. I grew up very comfortably. Look at the kind of places people live in. This is Manya. I've known her for about 3 years. So in conclusion, the military is stronger. U.S. collection is a symbol for the people. Aid does get through, but there needs to be more engagement. The U.S. and Myanmar need to know each other better. Some starting point. I think humanitarian issues are a good starting point. And there are good men in the military. Demonizing the whole military doesn't help. And this is our website. There's more pictures there. Thank you very much.
Well, Derek, I want to thank CSIS for pulling this together. It is a good opportunity to focus on the humanitarian issues. And actually, there are seats in front. I know it's always scary to sit in the front row, but there are at least 4 open chairs in the front row so people don't have to stand if you're stuck standing. You know, I think I'm relatively new to the Burma issue, and I'll confess that up front. But I have long experience working on humanitarian issues in Southeast Asia, and I think we all know that the Burma focus in Washington tends to be almost entirely on politics and human rights, and I think that's understandable given the situation. The effect, however, has been to hide or underplay the extent of the humanitarian problems faced by the Burmese people. And my other reaction coming into this new was that I think to the extent that humanitarian issues are discussed, they're very rarely placed within a broader international context. There's kind of the Burma discussion is very much focused, inward-looking. You know, it's very rare to see Burma put in a comparative perspective, everything seen through the prism of the necessity of punishing the evil regime. Now, to just throw out some basic data, and there some question as to the validity of statistics related to Burma, obviously, but if we're going to guess, we can probably guess that the situation is worse rather than better than what the public analysis is. The GDP per capita is the 13th lowest in the world. The average family spends 70% of its income on securing adequate food supplies. Under five child mortality is 104 per thousand, which is the second highest rate outside Africa after Afghanistan. Burma has the highest HIV rates in Southeast Asia. Malaria is the leading cause of mortality and morbidity. And finally, fewer than 50% of children complete primary school. Now, despite these indicators and the seriousness of the humanitarian problems that Burma faces, Burma receives less overseas development assistance per capita, $2.88 per person, than any of the poorest 50 countries in the world. The average of the poorest 50 countries is about $58 per person. And just to throw out some specific countries by way of comparison, Sudan receives $55 per person, Zimbabwe $21, and Laos $63. Now, everyone agrees that the government is primarily responsible for the abysmal level of poverty and deprivation in Burma. But as the list of comparative countries suggests, in my view, in the case of Burma, there's kind of a unique piling on. There's a double punishment of the Burmese people. They're punished by living under an oppressive, uncaring government, and they're punished by the international community for doing so as part of a strategy for political change that, frankly, has gotten very little result over the last 20 years. The European Commission and the United Kingdom have recently begun to recognize that this double punishment must end. Now, if you accept that argument, the question then becomes whether or not it's possible to do credible work inside Burma that meets international standards. To me, that's the crux of it. I think everyone agrees that there's need. The question is, can you meet the need in a way that doesn't, you know, provide aid and succor to the Burmese government? There's no question that the working environment is difficult, but is it more difficult than Cambodia in the 80s, or Zimbabwe, or Darfur right now? Sri Lanka is a relatively open society. In Sri Lanka, 17 aid workers were shot in the back 2 years ago, and there's still been no justice for those aid workers. Yet we still see a flow of humanitarian assistance to Sri Lanka. So I think we have to start asking the tough questions about what the real difficulties are in the Burmese operating environment and look at as objectively as we can at what's possible. And I think the main avenue for responding to humanitarian need inside Burma is international non-governmental organizations, which in turn are able to partner with local NGOs and community-based organizations. Now, the international NGOs depend on large complements of local staff. Save the Children in the aftermath of the cyclone is now up to 1,000 staff, Burmese staff. And they hire these staff independently. They don't have to be vetted by the government like they do in Darfur. And furthermore, these local staff are able to travel freely to project sites to develop and monitor programs. The geographic scope of international work in Burma had increased substantially even prior to the cyclone, with internationally supported activities in 300 of Burma's 325 townships. And after the initial blocking of international access, which was severe, the cyclone response has grown and intensified. The scale of the international presence has greatly increased. International NGOs now have offices throughout the Delta region, and a number of very significant international organizations, contrary to predictions in May, have been able to go in new to respond to the cyclone and have been able to stay. I'm thinking of Oxfam, Mercy Corps, and perhaps most significantly, the International Rescue Committee. IRC, is, as many of you know, is a major player at the border. They do cross-border assistance. They are now also inside working on cyclone relief, and I think that is extremely significant. Now, on the question of international standards, I'm going to go to the source. The Burma Campaign UK has a position paper on humanitarian aid to Burma. It's called Pro-Aid, Pro-Sanctions, Pro-Engagement. It's dated July 2006. I assume it's the latest version. It's what you get when you click on humanitarian on the Burma Campaign UK website. It's endorsed by the National Coalition Government of the Union of Burma, the Ethnic Nationalities Council of the Union of Burma, and 17 Burma campaign organizations, including the U.S. campaign. I think I do have time because I'm speaking quickly. So I'm going to go point by point. The right kind of aid, they list 10 principles. I'm going to say 7 are the international organizations are unequivocally able to abide by. 2 are still problematic, and 1, frankly, I question its relevance, but I'll get to that. It is essential, says the Burma Campaign UK, that agencies acknowledge the root cause of the crisis, which is poor governance. I think everyone says that. Some agencies say it publicly, others don't. I mean, I think Charles Petrie, the UN humanitarian and resident coordinator, who's been highly criticized by groups based in Thailand, you know, Charles was kicked out of the country for making the connection between poverty and governance last October. So I think there is wide public recognition that poor governance is at the root cause. Programs are transparent, accountable, and independently monitored. I think the international NGOs can demonstrate, again, primarily through their local staff, that they're able to monitor their programs directly. And certainly they have a complete commitment to transparency. The third principle is agencies have unencumbered access to project beneficiaries. Now, I'm going to put this in the problem category for sure. There's still a problem for international access to internally displaced people in conflict zones, especially in the eastern border areas. And there's a general problem of waiting for permission for international staff to get access to monitor programs. They can get there, but it's a matter in areas outside the cyclone area of a 3 or 4 week wait. In the cyclone area now, apparently it's down to 3 days, so that's been normalized somewhat. The question is, will the cyclone affected area rules begin to apply to the other part of the country? The next principle is agencies must be prepared to deliver assistance across national borders. This is the one I'm not sure I understand the relevance of. There's actually, on a per capita basis, much more aid going cross-border than there is inside. The monitoring issues are in some ways equally challenging. Cross-border reaches only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the Burmese population. So, you know, I can't see an agency that's based in Yangon leaving Burma and going to do cross-border work, because the cross-border work is vigorous and has been fully funded for a long time. Agencies insist on wide and democratic consultation with all stakeholders. This is primarily directed to the UN and donor governments, the need to consult with the NLD. I think there's no question that that's done. In the case of the Three Diseases Fund, the successor to the Global Fund, when the Global Fund was forced out of Burma, you know, in the British developed the Three Diseases Fund as an alternative. They consulted with the NLD. They got the NLD sign-off that this was okay, and they can produce documentation to that effect. Agencies maintain independence. This is about not having direct links with the government, especially at the national level. I think that's definitely met by the international NGO community. And I want to emphasize that the Burma Campaign UK statement says, delivery of assistance through decentralized local civilian administrations is supportable. Now, even at the local level, NGOs try and avoid working with local government. But if necessary, they'll do so if they can identify people who are credible. But most of the local level work is done with civil society organizations. Next principle: agencies afford protection for Burmese staff. That in our view is not a problem. National staff must be recruited on the basis of suitability. That's being done. Agencies support civil society. Unequivocal, yes. There is, I was actually, especially after what I heard before I went, I was really struck by the vibrance of Burmese civil society under very difficult circumstances. This is not North Korea. There are independent organizations that are able to maneuver, that are able to function. There are a host of self-help groups at the local level, and NGOs are partnering with those groups. Agencies promote respect for human rights is the next principle. This one I put in the problematic category. Agencies based in Burma do not tend to speak out on human rights issues for fear of being having their operations shut down. So you're not going to see SAVE out there, you know, with a bold statement condemning the Burmese government on human rights. That unfortunately is not going to happen. And then finally, agencies exercise care to avoid manipulation by the authorities. That's the whole thing of not playing into a process where the government gets to take credit for independent activity. I think the NGOs are incredibly sensitive to that and avoid it. So my point is the agencies are basically meeting the standards that the campaign organizations have set up. And I personally think that puts a challenge to the campaign organizations to say, you've got need, your principles are largely being met, let's go. Let's start advocating together for a holistic response to Burma's humanitarian problems, all in, inside the country, at the Thai-Burma border, the Chin in India, the Rohingya in Bangladesh, the Rohingya and the Chin and Malaysia. Let's go for it all in, looking at this problem holistically, but not neglecting the very serious problems inside the country. Finally, I'll leave you with four thoughts. The U.S. was giving $3 million inside Burma in U.S. government assistance prior to the cyclone, focused primarily on avian flu and HIV. This needs to increase substantially. You've got response to malaria and TB. You've got cyclone recovery. You've got work with the Rohingya, by far the most marginalized population in Burma, by far, the Rohingya in northern Arakan state. And we need to sustain the momentum generated by the relative opening as a result of the cyclone. So we're calling for at least $10 million in assistance from the U.S. and preferably more like $15 to $20 million. As I've argued, there are very close links between NGOs and Burma's civil society. There's a potential political payoff, but it will be very modest. And if you notice, I'm not selling aid inside Burma as in any way transformational from a political standpoint. The humanitarian justification is stronger than the political one. I'd prefer to stay in the humanitarian realm, but you can also argue that all these efforts add up to potentially something significant at the local level, but it's going to take a long time, and it needs drastic change, which I don't think can be achieved. It's like an international presence now gives faith and hope to people who otherwise would be even more downtrodden. But again, does this amount to a process of changing the political situation? I don't think so. The ASEAN role post-cyclone was critical. They provided the cover to allow for the international expansion and assistance that we've seen. I think we should continue collectively to work with ASEAN going forward. I think their role has been very positive. Then finally, the recovery in the cyclone-affected area does pose serious dilemmas. What is the Burmese government responsibility in terms of responding in a reconstruction and midterm development way? I personally agree with Human Rights Watch in criteria that they put out in May that large-scale infrastructure rehabilitation really has to be conditional on Burmese financial participation. They've got the money. But the problem is there's sort of a perverse outcome, because if the Burmese government is involved, you're more likely to have crony involvement and poor results. So you're sort of in this difficult, it's a difficult policy decision. I don't know what the best way to manage it is. I think at least from the outside, we need to ensure that NGOs and Burmese civil society organizations can take the small-scale work, the small-scale recovery of the kind that we saw previously. If we can nurture that through independent NGOs, I think that's something that we should continue to do, regardless of whether the Burmese government is willing to put up money for recovery or not. I didn't show beautiful and dramatic slides.
Well, first of all, thank you to CSIS for sponsoring this event today, and to Derek for inviting me. I think it's an incredibly important and timely subject, and one that is definitely worthy of further discussion. I very much appreciated Tetwin's photos and your presentation. It was excellent. You're doing excellent work in Burma, so thank you for doing that. And I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the sentiment that you expressed, that the people of the United States and Burma need to get to know each other better and develop further positive relations. I couldn't agree more on that front. And Joel, I couldn't agree more also on the concept of the need to be pro-aid, pro-sanctions, pro-engagement. And I think that that's where many in Congress would come out as well. And I speak today not as a implementer or as an advocate, but somebody that perhaps can give a political sense as to what might be doable or not doable in the Washington context on, as you pointed out, a subject with quite a long history and can be emotional at times. But perhaps I can talk a little bit about what might be possible. As Tetwin's photos clearly demonstrate, I think there's great recognition in Congress of the very grave humanitarian situation in Burma, both in the cyclone-affected areas and in the rest of the country. It's due not only, of course, to the cyclone, which was just absolutely devastating, but also to years of mismanagement of the economy. And I also think that the Refugees International Report and the post-Nargis joint assessment findings accurately paint a very negative humanitarian situation in Burma, and it's going to take years to recover as a result of the cyclone, and that's just the reality, and we have to be looking at it from the medium to long-term perspective. There's just not going to be a quick fix to the very desperate situation that faces the cyclone area. And as a result of this recognition of the humanitarian situation, I think that many in Congress, in fact, all of the chief critics of Burma for decades, were very supportive of the immediate assistance that was provided by the United States and other international donors after the cyclone. There was no objection. In fact, as U.S. assistance was loaded off the plane, handed directly to USDA officials, and giving the Burmese government great credit as they handed out the assistance, our assistance. There was no objection. And if somebody had told me that that was a possible outcome before the cyclone, I would have, you know, told them that they're on drugs. The reality is that Congress, it was a great humanitarian tragedy. Congress responded by recognizing that it was a great humanitarian tragedy. And as a result, there was great flexibility in terms of our view on what needed to get done in terms of the assistance. If anything, in Congress, there was great frustration that there was not, the assistance was not moving more quickly. NGOs have, including refugees, has raised a very important question, which is, can we make Burma a higher priority for assistance? Can we meet the outstanding balance in the UN appeal? Can we increase the food assistance? Can we move from humanitarian to reconstruction, particularly in the cyclone area? These are all incredibly good questions, timely questions, particularly as the initial U.S. assistance package is coming to a closure. It is the right time to figure out what we do next in Burma, because obviously, while the $50 million provided by the United States, you know, in terms of dollars, was needed, it was, it's, you know, not going to take care of the problem in the long term. So I think that I would like to stress that there is openness in Congress to the continuation of some assistance to Burma, particularly in the programs that are already underway in the cyclone area. And I think it's also important to think about that, you know, the subject of assistance to Burma, other parts of Burma, is certainly more complex because, Joel, as you point out, the rules as it relates to the distribution of assistance in the other parts of Burma has not really changed that much. So maybe our role can be, as the United States, a continuation of some programming in the cyclone-affected areas. But in terms of making Burma a top priority for U.S. humanitarian assistance, I do think that's going to be a tougher nut to crack. You know, members of Congress take snapshots of not just on Burma issue, but any foreign policy issue, and what they saw was the world community begging to provide assistance to the people of Burma. And our response to our efforts was, you know, no visas for the first week, the SBDC politicizing the aid that was being provided, creation of show camps to show that the Burmese government was just a bunch of swell folks. And this did not leave members of Congress with a very positive view about how the Burmese government views its role in terms of meeting the legitimate humanitarian needs of its own people. And I think over the past month or so, the NGOs have begun the process of explaining that after that initial negative reaction by the Burmese government, the circumstances have changed in the cyclone areas as it relates to the distribution of assistance. And it's just going to be a long slog to make up for that initial reaction. And I think that we just need to recognize that, that it doesn't mean that assistance from a congressional perspective can't be provided. It's just we need to understand that it's going to take a while to change people's vision about how the Burmese government is dealing with the cyclone area. You know, Congress is, of course, out of session. We won't really focus on this till next year. And even then, with the change in administration, when we come back full-time in January, there'll be a dozen other issues that will dominate our attention. But and there will also be other humanitarian crises in the world that will catch the eye. And as always, Congress, as a democratic representative institution, tends to respond to crises in situations where it's a democratic country, or perhaps they're interested in democracy, or maybe they like us, and none of which applies to Burma. And I also think that, you know, we're going to be more responsive to crises where we feel confident international NGOs are going to have the access they need. They can implement the aid in a manner that is consistent with international norms. And that, for instance, the corruption is manageable. It's a sad truth that Burma, of course, is the second to worst on Transparency's international recently released report about corruption in the world. That Burma's number, you know, the second worst country in the world. So we tend to be a little bit more responsive to countries that don't have any of these issues to deal with, or fewer of these issues to deal with. And then, as an example, Congress responded very positively in a supplemental appropriations bill with $75 million for the cyclone that hit Bangladesh last year. This was a cyclone that was the worst to hit Bangladesh since 1991. Thousands were killed. The food cycle was interrupted. People are still without homes. I was just in Bangladesh, and I can't go to Burma because they won't give me a visa, but I was greeted at the highest levels in Bangladesh. They were happy to have me go look at the cyclone areas. When you go down to the cyclone areas, there's huge signs thanking the American people, thanking the United Nations and other international agencies for the assistance that we provide. NGOs are operating there full-time. They don't have to beg for visas. If this is an important country that we should build relations with. It's a large, moderate Muslim nation. And so I raise that just to point out that, Congress is going to be responsive when the situation is perhaps more positive from our perspective. As I said, this doesn't mean that Congress is going to oppose the continuation of some humanitarian and development assistance in Burma. I don't believe it is. But as we evaluate the proposals that the next administration will come up with for the continuation of aid to Burma, I would look at several different factors. First of all, as already discussed, and Joel mentioned this as well, is that we need to look at what the Burmese government has done in terms of assistance. They have earned $100 million a month in terms of exporting gas. They have $3.5 billion in foreign reserves. And yet, they've only announced $4.4 million in cyclone relief. Now, I'm happy to be proven that there's new statistics and they've opened up the spigots and the Burmese government is now the largest contributor of humanitarian aid in the cyclone area. And if that's true, that's wonderful. But given that the latest statistics from WHO showed that the Burmese government spends $1 per person per year in funding health care, it's a little bit galling when I was happy to see the pictures of the new capital. Who paid for that? I mean, this is a government that makes a decision to spend billions of dollars building a new capital for no reason and moving the zoo from Yangon to the new capital, and yet has no money to help when their country is devastated by a cyclone and people have no food and no shelter. Wonder about that. And I think that that's something that Congress will be looking for, is a greater commitment to use their own money to help their own people. Second, again, we need further information, and Joel, you've started the process, and other NGOs have started this process, and thank you for doing this, about what kind of rules are going to be affecting international NGO workers, not only in the cyclone areas, but throughout the rest of Burma. And I think it's important that when independent analysis is done of the assistance that's been provided thus far, that there be, that they truly be independent analysis, and that SBDC representatives are not there when the interviews are conducted. My understanding is that they were there from the interviews associated with the post-Nargis joint assessment. Maybe that's wrong. But, in any event, if they're there, then obviously people are going to limit what they say. One of the issues that Joel mentioned that I think is valuable is, okay, if the goal here is we're going to provide assistance in the cyclone-affected areas in order to serve as a mechanism to increase aid to the rest of Burma, then the 3 to 4 week wait that's currently facing international NGO workers that wish to inspect internationally funded programs in the rest of Burma, that can't work. There's got to be a real-time ability to look at how our taxpayer monies are being spent, as it is in most other places in which we provide humanitarian assistance. So I think that that's sort of the rules affecting international NGO workers, and the transparency. It's got to change in the rest of Burma if, in fact, the cyclone area is going to be the wedge. Third, I would say that we've got to make sure that the indigenous Burmese NGOs and individual citizens that are providing assistance are allowed to participate. You know, many in Congress were concerned when two very high-profile officials who were involved in private relief efforts were thrown in jail. I mean, can you imagine that? That people who are raising money on their own to help people in the cyclone-affected areas in their own country are thrown in jail simply because they had the chutzpah to actually organize efforts on their own? I mean, that would be like Tet Win being thrown in jail because he went there to provide assistance. That's outrageous. Fourth, I think that we need to make sure that some of the charges that have been leveled against the international assistance that has been provided thus far in the cyclone areas are in fact no longer true. And if they're no longer true, that's wonderful. But these types of charges include the fact, or the charges that some of the assistance was being sold in stores with link to military commanders, that quality rice and quality supplies were not reaching the survivors, that assistance was being stolen by military officials, that land was being seized, that people were being forced off of their land in some of the cyclone-affected areas. Now, maybe some of this was in the initial weeks afterwards, and all these problems have been fixed, but I think one of the jobs for the NGO, since we in Congress can't go to Burma, one of the jobs in NGOs that NGOs need to do is demonstrate to us that these things are no longer true, these problems have been fixed. And that will certainly increase the confidence level that Congress may have in terms of continuation of our programming in the cyclone areas. Finally, the reality is that our assessments about assistance to Burma are going to be driven by the political situation there. There has got to be a meaningful dialogue with the NLD, with Aung San Suu Kyi, and the ethnic minorities. If the SBDC insists upon sticking to this post-Nargis referendum held days after their country was hit by the worst, natural disaster in its history, and to the 2010 elections without any representation or meaningful dialogue by anybody except the SBDC, it's difficult to imagine that Burma will move to the head of the priority list. Congress is a democratic institution, as I mentioned before, and it's no surprise that we react favorably to countries that have these institutions and don't crush them. And I think that refugees has made a very important point, which is that we need to find a way to support those military officials, and Tet, when you touched on this as well, those military officials that are more open and are more transparent and are more willing to work with us in terms of international assistance. And we need to find a way to work with them and try to further strengthen them. And I think that in that regard, as we move forward with the next stage of our assistance, we need to keep that in mind. I think that this is also a great opportunity for ASEAN to lead. I think that perhaps Singapore and Malaysia and the other increasingly wealthy countries of Southeast Asia perhaps could this could be a real opportunity for them and could have a proposal whereby, for instance, every dollar that the Burmese government spends, new dollar that they spend on cyclone relief, the Singaporeans and the Malaysians would be willing to match that. With the rising fuel prices and the rising food prices in around the world, our humanitarian and development dollars are being stretched quite thin, and I think it's time that our friends in ASEAN step up with something beyond technical assistance. It's not only up to us to provide humanitarian assistance to Burma, and I welcome Singapore using some of its great wealth to do that for us, for the international community. I think that if you look 5 months ago, it couldn't have been worse in terms of what the situation was, in terms of, tens of thousands of people killed and the economy destroyed and the government seemingly unconcerned about the impact of its own country. I think that I'm pleased that things have changed in the cyclone-affected areas, and I believe what the information that the NGOs are providing. So I think that there will be support in Congress for the continuation of some programs in Burma. that meet international standards, that are properly monitored, that don't give credit to the Burmese government. And I think many of the programs that we're currently doing there might fit that bill. I would say that if we can do that, then I think we can begin the process of meeting our legitimate humanitarian aspirations as a country while also meeting our fiduciary responsibilities as taxpayers. So thank you.
Thanks very much to all three. I think the three excellent presentations that set the table for what I hope will be an active discussion over the next 40 minutes, 45 minutes or so. I was rude when I started. I did not acknowledge that we are co-sponsoring this, so I apologize to that. I see Jack there from Asia Society and, of course, Matt Daly from U.S. ASEAN Business Council, who did a lot to get the notices out and to help us with this event. So I want to note their contributions, and I apologize for not mentioning at the start. Good to have you here. I want to open it up, but let me just start by a question of my own, comment and question. I had mentioned in my opening that when I met with Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, a long time ago, and this issue came up, she said there are really two criteria that were important, and they were mentioned or referred to here generally. One is that it had to get right to the people, so it was effective, and secondly, it didn't empower the government in the process. I'm curious, maybe I'll ask Peter on this, on the policy side of the United States, sort of a two-part question. First of all, how much is the NLD a part of the discussion when you think about policy and what you want to do when it comes to humanitarian aid? To what degree are they the real arbiter for people on the Hill as to what is appropriate and what is not, and the other representatives, whether it's NCGUB or others? And secondly, is there any, and I can't quite get my mind around this, I had the understanding that there was actual legislation that prevented humanitarian assistance. You talked about using taxpayer money for humanitarian aid. That's separate from actually allowing others to do humanitarian assistance in Burma. Is there legislation that actively constrains the ability to do humanitarian work in Burma?
On the first question, I think that from the perspective of many in Congress, the NLD does remain, a touchstone for analyzing proper developments in humanitarian assistance in Burma. If there had been a free and open society or civil society, maybe there'd be new political entities that would have emerged in the interim that would be, different, and people could reach out to other groups. But that's sort of the last time we had it, and it was the NLD. And, of course, as you said, people are very much interested in Aung San Suu Kyi's view on these issues. And, of course, we can't have that because of the continued imprisonment of her. I would say that on the cyclone assistance, it was a natural, immediate humanitarian assistance instinct by the United States. I don't think there was extensive, desire to make sure that the NLD was okay with every aspect of that was going to be provided in the cyclone areas. The goal was to move money, move assistance out the door and help people, which we did. In terms of development assistance in terms of the medium and long term in Burma, I think that there is much more of an interest in making sure that the NLD is consistent with that, is okay with that. And in the past, there have been some carefully constructed programs inside Burma on development-type issues that the NLD has agreed to. So I think that remains important from our perspective. In terms of legislation, there was language on the UNDP requiring presidential certifications that they were meeting certain standards and these certifications were met. And the president made those certifications. I think that when we're looking at international NGOs, we're looking that they work with the grassroots level, work with local NGOs, work with individual folks, and don't ensure that their aid does not provide direct benefit to the government itself.
Joel, you want to talk? Just very quickly, NGOs operating even with their own funding, U.S.-based NGOs operating with U.S. dollars do have to get licenses from the Treasury Department under the Foreign Assets Control Regulations. Burma is an embargoed country. Now, our understanding from discussing with many individual organizations is that this process itself has not been a problem. I mean, if there were a true aid embargo in place, as I learned in the 80s when I was dealing with Cambodia and Vietnam, you know, the Treasury Department could deny licenses to international NGOs using U.S. dollars even for humanitarian projects, but they do not do that right now.
Against aid, at least at that point. So it was certainly before 2002 where she was saying the right kind of aid is okay, but certainly that's difficult in that environment to make sure that it's not empowering the regime and it's getting to the people.
Can I make a couple comments, which is, first of all, it's true that generals can't get visas to come to the United States. I'd say, though, that the Chinese, of course, sponsored a very helpful, you know, attempted to sponsor a process. I think that Chinese and other officials should be trying to find new other types of mechanisms to find ways to bridge the gap between the U.S. and Burma. There's this view that sometimes Congress is opposed to dialogue with the government, and that is just absolutely wrong. What we're opposed to is, giving the Burmese government what it wants right up front. But in terms of a dialogue, absolutely. I mean, you know, I agree with our Democratic presidential candidate that we should need to have a dialogue. second of all, the UNDP, we require prior consultations with the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi, and we did have those prior consultations, and they approved UNDP programming. So it was not an onerous condition since in fact, the certification was repeatedly met. And thirdly, I would say that, well, I understand why they felt for astrological reasons that the referendum, needed to move forward. At some point, one would hope that there's also some common sense that, you know, when your country's devastated and tens and hundreds of thousands of people might die, that at some point you say, okay, well, I know that we wanted to have our referendum on that date, but maybe we'll save the lives of our people instead. And I understand not giving visas to foreigners for that first week, but they didn't even take aid for that first week. And that I don't understand at all. I mean, you have people lined up to provide aid right away. Ships, you know, willing to just drop it. Didn't want any of that. So. I'd say that I think that the ability of sanctions to work in Burma in terms of actually changing the view of the government and the actions of the government is fundamentally dependent upon the U.S. not going it alone. We are trying to, for over a decade now, lead by example. Europeans have been coming along slowly, and while their perspective on aid may be changing, their perspective on sanctions has not been changing. And I think the ASEAN countries themselves have begun to realize that perhaps they made a mistake in allowing Burma into ASEAN. That said, the sanctions themselves obviously haven't changed. The Burmese government, it's still there, and it's still in power. So from our perspective, we need to continue to pursue these sanctions actively. We're very happy that the Black Burma Jade Act was recently signed into law by President Bush. And it's our hope that the Europeans follow. And in fact, they've already taken some actions on gems, Burmese gems and jade, that are not quite as fulsome as ours. But I wouldn't be surprised if over the next couple of years you'll find that the international market for rubies and high-quality jade will dry up. That hopefully, over the long term, will have a salutary effect in terms of making the Burmese generals understand that there will be an economic price to pay when they continue to refuse to deal with the opposition. They refuse to have elections and run their country in a decent manner.
What about the cost to individual business spend in the private sector?
I think it's enormous. I have no doubt that when our sanctions do affect many independent business people in Burma and, as they did in South Africa. And, of course, South Africans were very pleased when they were liberated, and they were happy to acknowledge the important role that international sanctions placed in their liberation. We hope that one day Aung San Suu Kyi will be giving us similar thanks.
I think in the country, there's rice is available. There's lots of rice, but the people don't have jobs to buy the food. So I'm not an economist. I can't speak about that very well, but unemployment is so huge, and people are just doing farming jobs and working as servants, the very working class people. So had there been those textile factories still in existence, maybe they could have a better life. But Aung San Suu Kyi has called for the sanctions, and the U.S. supports her, so I think it's going to stay in place. I don't know how it can help other countries. I mean, generals don't make their money on commerce or business. They have one big-time deals. You want to build a hotel? It's a multi-million dollar deal, one shot. They don't make money from the guests that come. They don't make money from the tourism. It's just one shot, and they make all that money. You want to bring some cars in, construction equipment? It's all one shot. So they make money, you know, it changes hands immediately. So sanctions, I don't think affect them.
First of all, I should stress, Refugees International does not take a formal position on sanctions. I think in our first bulletin we did say that we, the targeted sanctions that really get to the economic interests of the ruling generals, that if you're going to have sanctions, that's the way to go. But if I can step outside of my RI role and just give a personal opinion, I mean, I'm really torn. I think if we look at the way political change has occurred in the world over the last 40 or 50 years, it usually hasn't been from isolation, it's been from engagement. And yet to do principled engagement with Burma the way that country is run, I don't know where you even start with that. So I hate to, luckily this isn't a presidential debate, but I'm basically gonna wimp out. I mean, I really do see both sides of the sanctions argument. If you push me to a wall, I would say a review of the way political change occurs suggests that engagement would be the way to go, and the idea would be to allow investment, but then you run into a brick wall because any investment in Burma, the way the economy is organized right now, basically has to benefit the generals. There's no way around that, and I think that's problematic. That's why I'm more comfortable in the humanitarian space, where I truly believe that the independent NGO work that's done really doesn't benefit. I don't buy that whole substitutionality argument. I mean, whether the NGOs are there or not, the Burmese government would not be investing in the Burmese people. So, again, that gets me right back to, can you do credible work? If the answer is yes, I think you definitely support it, because it really, to be so cynical as to say, we're going to try and make the Burmese people so poor that there's going to be a popular uprising, I mean, there's absolutely no record of that happening, I think. So, but on economic sanctions, I'm really torn. I don't have a clear answer on that.
Yes, with the sanctions, if I know your first question about the laws regarding humanitarian aid or sending money to Burma. There are many laws. There's U.S. Treasury has many laws. I don't know all the laws, but I know IRS sends me a letter almost every month. So I have to take care of that. When I started this organization, I started with Chevy Chase. After 2 months, they shut my account down. They didn't give me a reason. So I moved it to Bank of America, and they closed my account again. Then I moved it to Morgan Stanley, and then they shut it down. So I'm not going to tell you. So I'm not going to tell you where the money is now. But I don't know how it happened. But then they started working on my personal account, and that got closed. So there is some network that monitors anything related to the word Burma or Myanmar, I think. There are laws, like I said, I don't know them all, but somebody is monitoring the situation. I think if somehow, if you could ease some laws about sending money in, like there were some slides here about, there was a restaurant that I showed. This woman had started her restaurant under a tree. And I believe it was a French or a German tourist had ate some of her food and loved it, and he gave her like $5,000 equivalent cash on the spot. And she started building the restaurant little by little. So that helps the local merchant, that helps the waiters there, it helps the local people, the local markets. I think if you ease those sort of sanctions, it's helpful for the people. They can make their own living. But larger things, you know, that's not my department. I can only speak street level.
Peter, do you have any idea why that's happened? As far as law?
I mean, that's very interesting. Yeah, with state, I don't know. Sounds like Treasury's very busy. No, I don't.
I mean, as far as law, you don't see that?
No, I mean, as Joel pointed out, there is a licensing process by which funds can be transferred to Burma for humanitarian purposes. So, you know, why, I mean, you know, why your accounts are being closed, I don't know. So.
It was, okay, the question was to four people, but I will suspend my response to the sanctions question. Get madder than Brian.
Sorry, I agree with you on the need to. I mean, but the rules are clear on investment versus selling. If companies choose on their own that they don't want to take the risk or the hassle of complying with U.S. laws vis-a-vis selling to Burma, that's a business decision they're making. That's not a policy decision that we've made. We allow people to sell to Burma. They're choosing for whatever reason not to sell there. And if they don't sell medical supplies to Burma, well, then that's a decision they're making. On the subject of letting civilians and their children come to the United States and their family members, you know, again, I do think we are open to dialogue. I think this is dialogue that can certainly be achieved in third countries. But I think we're trying to send the message here that you run your country into a ground, you put Aung San Suu Kyi in prison, you arrest everybody in that position, and you treat your people with utter disrespect by letting them basically live in, you know, incredible poverty. There's going to be consequences. Your children can't come to the United States and study at our institutions. There will be a price you're going to pay if that's the way you're going to behave. And I'm sorry, they make that decision, and that's fine. They choose to do that. But it doesn't mean that we're opposed to dialogue. If we want to have dialogues in third countries, that's great. Also, it's a two-way street. They don't let people go to Burma. Everybody that wants to go to Burma go there. So we should let everybody come here, but they don't have to let us go to Burma. So, I mean, it's a two-way street. Maybe a third country could facilitate a process by which we could open up the entire process, not just us. Then feel free to choose five other countries that have an interest in Singapore. Well, that's not a democracy. Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia. Any one of those would be perfect to sponsor a process with the Burmese to talk about all the issues that we have. I mean, but if it's not the Chinese, let somebody else choose it. That's fine.
You're going to clarify.
Okay. Well, now things are going to get controversial, probably, because I Saffron Revolution, that was not a revolution. I mean, Saffron Revolution is a kind of romantic outside marketing term. What happened, as you know, is that because of economic pressure, the monks decided to protest peacefully. It built through connections and networks within Burmese society, and there was, partially because of the intense crackdown, and I didn't follow it closely enough to know which came first and kind of what it was day to day, but I mean, at some point it went from a silent protest against poverty to the quote unquote Saffron Revolution, and I just really question. It was a revolution without a platform, with very little prospect for success. The government crushed it viciously, and again, I raised that precisely because it's just too cynical to me. In other words, I want this discussion actually to be precisely about humanitarian assistance and where that fits in to how we view any kind of change process inside Burma. And what really worries me, quite frankly, is that the reason, and is Jennifer Quigley here?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. I mean, the reason the position of the U.S. campaign for Burma really frustrates me is because I think, frankly, underlying it is this idea of let's make the people so poor that they rise up. And that is simply not going to happen. And if it does happen, it's going to be crushed. Crushed exactly the way it was. I mean, you travel around. I traveled in Cambodia in the 80s when Cambodia was under assault. There were Vietnamese soldiers everywhere. It was an embattled country. It was a place at risk. It was a place at war. I traveled to southeastern Burma at the end of February and beginning of March. You don't see any soldiers. There are no checkpoints. I mean, we've got to get real here. There is not an incipient revolution that is going to overturn this government. Maybe through people power, you could begin to build some kind of movement that might embarrass the regime. But the minute their true interests are threatened, they're going to crush it. And to say let's make people poor so that they rise up, I'm sorry, that's unacceptable.
Since I was sort of called out, that is not the policy of the U.S. campaign for Burma. We do not want the people to be poor and to rise up. So I just have to unequivocally say why it's just outright outlandish to even make an accusation like that. That's not who we are as an organization.
Well, what is your position then?
Our position on which issue? I mean, apparently this debate
on humanitarian assistance inside Burma.
You saw. We are signatory to the pro-sanctions, pro-engagement, pro-aid paper.
I think I've spoken to Simon Billiness a few times about this. His idea is to weaken the regime through the sanctions and part of the people power. I mean, that's their strategy. They can stick with that. The Saffron Revolution, how it affected me personally was it made me very saddened and fearful of what can happen to people who protest. I have been inside Burmese prisons before. There's a reason that, Human Rights Watch and other groups are not allowed in these prisons because these prisons are like pigsties. And I'm sorry, I always get emotional when I think about it. People don't have handcuffs there, so they put barbed wire, okay? And you just squat in a prison stall. The only reason I know this is because I bailed somebody out. It's better to have them out of prison, I think. I don't mind paying somebody off to get somebody free. I mean, that's the nature of the country. It's, like I said, 100 years behind, right? Here you have bail bonds. And there you pay somebody off. You get the guard a cup of tea, and then the next person you give them a bottle of liquor, something. Works like that, cigarettes. I mean, maybe... You might think I feed the corruption, but people are very poor. And when you're very poor, you start to compromise. It's very difficult when there's a huge poor population. It's very difficult to make ends meet. You know, you don't want to do these things, but, when you live in darkness, you're going to commit sins.
I guess my thought would be that whether it was a saffron revolution or a saffron movement, or a saffron group of folks. It was not driven from outside. It was driven from real anger from within inside. They're angry. They don't have any money. They feel like nobody's listening to them. And one thing leads to another, and they're on the streets, and people come out to support them. Whether they actually ever had a chance of having a people power Philippine-style revolution, I wasn't there. I don't know. But I do think that it... and it gets the term saffron revolution because people are grasping at anything to try to push for to encourage change. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's you know, people want change in Burma, and they'll look at anything. So I can't say for sure whether ever had a chance, but I do think it was not. I think it was homegrown. I don't think it was pushed from the outside. In terms of the concept that this purpose of sanctions is to make people poor, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think that that's the platform. The goal is that those folks that are in position to make decisions about the future of their country are going to pay an economic price for their unwillingness to explore other options. It is possible and likely that as part of that process that the country itself will be poorer than it was before, but that is not the intent. The intent is to get decision makers to make alternative decisions that they're certainly capable of making. And in fact, in other areas where other countries where sanctions have been used, this has happened. So,
I want to follow up. Brian, what's your analysis? I mean, you asked us, so what? I mean, what's behind the question? I mean, what?
I'm not on the panel. My point is.
But I have to say, though, I think that the whole conversation was about the fact that the events of the last year has changed things, and that this is maybe a wedge. The cyclone and everything else means we are in a different situation. That the debates of 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, or even a year ago, have made this discussion more relevant and more interesting. As a result, we ought to be thinking freshly about it. I think everyone has thought about how can we use this, and what have we discovered by working in Burma because of this that we can use to change our approach, and given the continuing problem, which is political. I mean, how do we get in there, make a real difference, using the wedge, but not alter that bottom line, which is to empower that regime in any way that makes things worse for the Burmese people rather than better, which is what this is all about. If I just may jump in just very briefly on this issue of making the people suffer so that they rise up, I too have to say I've never heard that as an argument made by anybody. In the 90s, when I was sort of involved in the other side, you know, encouraging sanctions, the idea was that there was not only going to be an economic price for what's going on, but a political price for Burma. And it gets back actually to South Africa, which I'd also worked on as a very young green kid 20 years ago. And my first thing I did when I worked on Capitol Hill in 1986 was South African sanctions. And there was a very similar dynamic where you had Desmond Tutu coming over as the most credible representative, given Mandela was in prison, of ANC, saying, we want you to sanction us. And people would say, well, you're going to only hurt the ones you want to help. He said, we're already hurting. Sanction us. We need the signal from the international community to say this is not appropriate action and that the people in this government need to be, you know, politically isolated. Now, of course, when you talk in the Burmese context, political isolation is not exactly new for them or harsh. But there was that symbolic aspect of sanction us, because we need to see that commitment from the international community, and only by doing that you can get others to go along. Others in Southern Africa did go along, others in Asia are not. So it was a considered judgment at the time to stand by Aung San Suu Kyi, stand by the NLD, and see where this led. 10 years later, you look at it and say, obviously it hasn't worked. But nor has, or at least the sanctions in place haven't worked, nor has constructive engagement worked. So now we're struggling with, we have a new situation, we're having this, we should not have the same debate, but we should use what we've got to figure out how to find the right mix to get this moving forward. Humanitarian assistance, given the past year, really gets to the top. I mean, not that they weren't in a dire situation before, but now certainly they do.
I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, okay? Before the cyclone, the U.S. was giving $3 million in humanitarian assistance to one of the poorest countries in the world. Now, if the rationale isn't to keep the people poor so that they will rise up, and I'll accept that, everyone's denying that couldn't possibly, everyone's saying that couldn't possibly be the case, what is the rationale? You've got the U.S. Embassy in Rangoon recommending that the U.S. do more. You've got the regional office of USAID recommending that the U.S. do more. And this gets sent, these recommendations get sent back to Washington and go into a policy process where the net result is we are doing virtually nothing pre-cyclone to respond to humanitarian need inside Burma. So if the rationale isn't making the people poor, what is the rationale? The rationale, I assume, is, well, you know, if it's not that, then perhaps it's that you know, you can't do effective assistance, or you don't want to sucker the government, or whatever. But it's just the difference between the need and what the U.S. was doing was vast.
Well, I mean, the job of embassies around the world is to make recommendations for increasing aid to their country. And it comes back to Washington, and it immediately gets shaved down by 75%. I mean, that's the sad reality is that, you know, there's not enough assistance, humanitarian development, to meet the massive humanitarian development needs around the world. And when it comes back to Washington, and I'm not familiar with the particular recommendations made, and obviously I was not at the State Department at the time or AID, but when that comes back to Washington, you look back and think, okay, we can provide humanitarian assistance or development assistance to a country that likes us, is willing to work with us, lets our international NGOs operate by commonly accepted standards, or we can twist arms and shave the rules and create special rules just for Burma and provide more money to them. It's not a lack of understanding or comprehension or sympathy for the plight of the Burmese people. It's just, frankly, it's a lot easier to spend development and humanitarian money elsewhere where they would like us to come. So,
one comment, Brian. Good to see you again after 8 years. as Derek was saying, there is some sort of wedge. There's going to be more political developments, I think, because there was a referendum, and there's going to be an election. It's not up to our standards, but they don't know how to have an election. And even within themselves, they're all struggling. They're wondering, how are we going to pull off an election? Because all we've ever gotten is orders from above. You do this, you do this, you do this, I give you this. It's a very feudal system. But now they're going to have an election, and they're all starting to form their own groups. They're kind of learning democracy in their own little group, how to network with each other and what they've always been divided, you know, from the top. So they're kind of powerless. People who come here, one of my uncles was here as a military counsel, and they sent him here because he was getting too popular with the troops. Once you're an embassy official, that's because you're too popular. They want you out. After you're ambassador, you retire. Okay? So things are going on internally. I mean, that's right here. I think I'm an optimistic person. I believe there's hope. I don't want to call it pressure. Maybe I'm a gentle person. You want to call it friendship. Some sort of friendship society should develop, or some sister city programs. I mean, these seem like very minor things or soft things, but I think these things work. Or student exchange, military official exchange, visitations. My parents and I, we've always received invitations from the Myanmar embassy for parties. My parents don't go anymore. I still go because it's about friendship, person to person, interpersonal relations. And there are other people from other countries there, too. And maybe the ambassador is a non-player, but it's a start. And you make friends there. And like I said, it occurs on the very street level, local level. You make friends. And then I believe different changes can come from that. So I guess to answer your question, the international involvement, it has to start at its very grassroots level. That's the only thing I can speak to.
I would also say that I think that the continuation of some element to the cyclone assistance can play a role in terms of sending a signal that the U.S. is, wishes to be helpful to the Burmese people. I think that a new administration across the front, whether it's a McCain administration or an Obama administration, will have an opportunity to send strong signals to a variety of countries that were prepared to look at things differently. And I think that trying to find an opportunity to engage with the Burmese government at a high level, not necessarily in the United States, but someplace else, and propose some sort of step-by-step process by which the Burmese government would take a certain set of actions and the U.S. would respond in a certain way. I mean, this is fairly standard fare for how to deal with rogue regimes, and certainly worth a try with Burma. It may not work, but all we've lost is airfare to and from whatever city's hosting it. So I think it's worth a try. I think ASEAN, their views of Burma has changed significantly over the last 2 to 3 years. I think the views of Europe have changed as well. So I think that a leadership role by the United States to have some sort of new high-level diplomatic initiative vis-a-vis Burma would be welcome. I mean, the Europeans and their friends in ASEAN would probably be pleased as punch that we're trying something new. So it's worth a try. Whether it works, who knows?
Joel, do you have a thought?
I think there's a place for more positive incentives to Burma to test. I mean, we have a lot of negative incentives of sanctions and such, but things that suggest that if you do this, some positive things can flow. You hear a lot more from the region about the issue of six-party talks surrounding Burma, using that same process to engage Burma in a certain way. And I think we should examine that in ASEAN and with China and India and make a real effort. I mean, there's now legislation that calls for a special envoy to Burma or special representative or whatever that supposedly is going to be announced in the last few months of this administration, though I don't know what he is going to be able to do in the last few months of this administration. But you do see evolution within ASEAN. I mean, Indonesians are very interested in human rights now, the parliamentarians and the government as well. Filipinos, the Philippine government, they both have not signed the ASEAN Charter, in part because of concerns over these issues, and I hear directly from both of concern. So perhaps we can work more closely with interest there. It's fascinating. When I left the issues, again, about 10 years ago, Indonesia was a model for Burma. They wanted to be, dui fungsi and, dual role for the government, for the military and government and in national security. And suddenly Indonesia is not what they want to be and not their model. And they're much more on our side. So there's much more I think we can do if we have the bandwidth as a government, given that we have about 45 other major priorities to focus on at home and abroad in the coming years. But there's certainly a lot more we can do in reaching out. Do we have any final? Yes, sir.
I just wanted to comment on the observation that ASEAN could play a critical role, as Bill said, in terms of opening up the activities towards the relief efforts. When the Secretary General was here, I think Jack Leisure Society hosted an event at Vientiane, Chamber of Commerce, where this was breaking news, and he got on the plane to go back and actually used the word that you used, Eric, wedge. He wanted to use this as a wedge, and he thought, well, okay, this guy is a good talker, but in fact, it turned out to be the case. He could use it as a wedge, in part because ASEAN has been engaged with Burma over the years, and also because ASEAN has had a credible avenue to pursue. At least they have a committee on disaster management that has been active in the area, and so they have real sort of value added that they could go on. Not only are we next to you, not only are we a member of our group, we have something that tangible to do in terms of helping to orchestrate the humanitarian system. Finally, Peter mentioned, could ASEAN countries contribute? I think by the middle of May, the last numbers I saw, they have contributed some $2.5 million to the rebound. But I also want to come back to your point, Derek, that you both made to speak up, and that's the human rights issue. Mm-hmm. ASEAN now has, they've all signed charters, been ratified. Burma has, in fact, ratified the charter. The charter has provision for a human rights body. You're absolutely right. The Philippines and Indonesia were central to getting that in the charter. Has no teeth yet, has no terms of reference. But the point is, when you have a human rights body that is sanctioned by international law of the ASEAN Charter, it can, over time, perhaps take hold. And it's just remarkable that countries like Singapore and Vietnam and others have signed on to this body. So I think this engagement and looking at things over a long period of time has some merit. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Yes, please, Joel.
on the ASEAN role, one of the main things I think that was accomplished that could be promising for the future is maybe reducing the fear level of the Burmese government from off the charts to from like over off the charts to like 98 out of 100, their fear of objective studies of what's actually going on. The Ponja did involve Burmese officials. It was a tripartite mechanism, ASEAN, UN, and the government. But the findings have been accepted as objective and are being used as the basis to mount the relief effort. Now, prior to the cyclone, WFP had a tentative agreement with the government to lead a study of humanitarian conditions in Karen State and Mon State in southeastern Burma. That process was aborted in the tension between the UN and the Burmese government over the Charles Petrie statements. I think one possibility would be to try and build on the Ponja to do some kind of objective assessment of humanitarian conditions in southeastern Burma. I don't think that assessment would go into the so-called black zones, the zones that are truly contested close to the Thai-Burma border, but it at least opens the possibility of trying to begin a process of objectively assessing what's going on, getting closer to those zones than the international community has been able to do so far.
Okay. I have to say, as I listen to what's been discussed today, I'm quite encouraged, and more encouraged than I expected, because I sense a kind of consensus here, particularly on the humanitarian aid issue. And I mean, it extends from what Brian's saying, where maybe we have an opportunity because of events, where I would say 10 years ago was much more vociferous, where, you know, engage in humanitarian aid, don't engage in humanitarian aid. It was a lot starker. But what I hear from the panel is that there is a consensus that there is effective work being done, that more work should be done, that there is no desire to prevent it, that the Burmese regime is perhaps a little more open to it. At least you can work with the system to have it done. And I don't know if that's the way everyone sees it or not. And maybe I'll leave the final question or comments to that. Are you encouraged by maybe to start with the Congress? I mean, do you see, for instance, as I heard from the House perspective, is there a Senate difference with you on this, first of all? In other words, are you encouraged that at least there is an openness, a new openness or a fresh ability to look at this flexibly on the Hill and allow things to move on the humanitarian side?
I think that there is great consensus between the House and Senate on the subject of Burma, certainly more consensus than there are differences. And as I said, I mean, there's openness to the continuation of the types of assistance that is currently being provided in the humanitarian area, in the cyclone-affected areas, which, are coming closer to international norms as it relates to monitoring international aid. So as we end this administration and look towards the next administration, I know the administration is contemplating its options, these are the types of issues that we're interested in terms of, you know, the next proposal for the continuation of assistance for the cyclone-affected areas in Burma. We'll look at these issues, yeah.
My reaction would be a couple thoughts. One is I think, my colleague Sean Garcia and I have been working on this a lot, I think the NGOs that are working inside Burma need to do a much better job at describing the working environment. And they need to come to Washington, give public briefings, and really, really explain what the difficulties are that they face and what they've been able to achieve. I like to be optimistic, but I think there's still fundamentally a lack of trust between the campaigners on the outside and the NGOs on the inside. The second point I would make is just to react to something that Peter said some time ago. I mean, RI is not calling for Burma to be the number one humanitarian priority of the United States, neither worldwide nor even in Asia. All we're talking about is going from virtually nothing to a little bit more. And we know that that will have to be negotiated. We know that that will be fraught. You know, we don't have any illusion that, you know, Burma is going to become the number one humanitarian priority. And, you know, I think our own advocacy goals on that score are rather modest. Finally, in terms of the criteria that Peter outlined, I think all of them can be met, you know, the sort of bottom line criteria as to what we can do. However, when, Peter, you say there's got to be a meaningful dialogue with the NLD and the ethnic minorities, again, if we start holding back humanitarian assistance, that was your last criterion.
Right, for looking at the concept of overall development and humanitarian decisions in Burma over the medium and long term. But in terms of, you know, my point is, we've talked about the political situation, is that if there's a difference, if there's a political situation is good, there's going to be even more of a willingness to provide humanitarian assistance. But I was not saying that if there's no dialogue with the NLD at the moment that we're opposed to humanitarian assistance. I'm just saying that there's a relationship between the two vis-a-vis the amount, the quality, the quantity. You know, there is a relationship, and that's just the reality. But I'm not saying if there's no dialogue, there's
okay.
No.
Okay, that wasn't clear. I thought you were saying that was one of five criteria for the provision of assistance.
No.
I think anything is possible in Myanmar. It's going to take time. It takes a lot of experience. I believe it takes place on an interpersonal level. I believe through economic incentives. I think Derek and Professor Green here at CSIS always mention a carrot and stick approach. I think you can bring out many progressive leaders in Myanmar to agree to certain things, to agree to reform. I'm very hopeful, but it's going to take more innovative approaches to dealing with the leadership. As Joel says in his bulletin, a new way forward. I really like that title. I think we need to think in a new way, and it's possible, and there is hope. Things are not as bad as they seem, as they are portrayed by the news or the democracy movement. It's natural that, you know, they portray this things as being horrible because it's a good strategy, and horrible things are happening. I think I tried to be fair in the slides to show that there's, you know, life goes on there. Terrible things are happening, but there is hope. It's not as bad as it seems.
Well, I want to thank all the panelists. As suggested, this is an issue that's not going to change very soon, requires flexibility. But I think the lack of trust, which was mentioned, I think, by Joel, is also very critical. And hopefully we can do more of these to continue the discussion so that understanding on all sides of what's going on there and what the possibilities are clear. But please join me in thanking the three panelists.